might have heard of me and my family. We the niggas who had the tiger in the projects and fucking in Harlem. And shit. You ever heard about that shit? And I'm like, yeah, because I did hear about it. I remember seeing on the news somewhere or in a magazine that they found a motherfucking tiger in a motherfucking project apartment in New York City. But, you know, we hip-hopping and recording and shit, so I'm not really focusing on what he just said to me. Like, if a motherfucker tell you they got a tiger in the projects, that shit, you like, all right, yeah. That shit just goes over your head. You know what I'm saying?
Welcome to Subject Object Verb, presented by Art Review. I'm your host, Ross Simonini. Speech is an egalitarian medium. Long before we put glyphs and images onto rocks or pages, we spoke to each other. And it's an art form that still has potency. Today's episode features Shabalala Self, who primarily works as a painter, making colorful figurative work out of fabric scraps and studio debris. But for her recent exhibition titled Cottonmouth at Eva Press in Huber, New York, she created her first audio work, which the gallery released on vinyl. It also played in the exhibition on loop, while Self's new body of paintings hung on the wall. The piece is about 15 minutes long, and it begins with Self talking into her phone while driving her regular commute between New Haven, Connecticut and New York City. She's thinking out loud, talking very candidly about her intentions for her upcoming show, trying to sort her thoughts on oral history and black pop culture, which are its central themes. The piece then catalogs her omnivorous media diet with clips from the news, lifestyle commentators, and various YouTube personalities from black culture. It's a disorienting trip of a listening experience that recalls the recent video collages of Arthur Jaffa. In today's episode, you'll hear some excerpts from Cottonmouth collaged together with a conversation I had with Self over Zoom during the run of her show.
A lot of times when I'm driving, I will be thinking a lot about projects or coming up with ideas, sorting through ideas, and one of the times when I was driving, I was, you know, thinking about my upcoming show. This would have been over a year ago. I was thinking about my upcoming show with Eva and just wanted to take some notes about what a lot of different things that were kind of circulating around in my mind. And through the process of taking those notes, this audio piece emerged. So it was totally just spontaneous, and it was the stream of consciousness, me just riffing off of these various ideas that were coming into my head, different things that I was thinking about previously, and trying to patch them together. And the monologue was really born out of that process.
Okay, idea for Eva, President Huber show. Thinking about how to place a black mythology. Thinking about how to collapse all of my ideas in regard to pop culture, black pop culture, ideas thinking about black pop culture, how black pop culture informs my practice. I believe that black pop culture is a fascination of mine because black pop culture is the oral history of the contemporary black mythology. Within black pop culture, all ideas, contemporary fiction and fact, become collapsed into one cohesive, one ever-evolving, inconsistent but consistent narrative around blackness. Blackness as in the kind of blackness I possess, the kind of blackness that is possessed by me. I am born out of the reality of Black America.
I'm under the belief that oral history is one of the main vehicles by which, you know, history, memory, and culture has been like transmitted like throughout the diaspora. And then I was kind of looking at it first through that vantage point, and then looking at it more narrowly in the context of Black American identity and imagining that, again, in this context as well, like this oral history is primarily the vehicle by which a lot of information is transmitted. And the first thing that comes to mind is obviously like music. That's probably the most accessible and most obvious example. But I think it goes way deeper than that. It can go into certain kind of colloquialisms. This Black American vernacular, those are all other ways in which culture, memory, ideas are kind of communicated through this kind of oral exchange, this dialogue. So I guess in me contributing to my monologue to, well, me kind of having this monologue, I guess I was kind of contributing to into that pot. Well, if you're trying to talk about a certain medium, it makes sense to talk about that medium within the medium. So because I was talking about oral history, it did make sense then to, you know, make a sound piece in response to it.
Also saying that she doesn't consider herself Black. So for her to use that gorilla or monkey emoji,
she should have never did that. She should have never did that.
She should have never did that. And she's too old to not know what she's doing. She needs to hold herself accountable.
This is why should not have said, she should have not posted that monkey. She should not have done that. She should not have done that. That was the icing on the cake for her. That was the piece that was needed for the people to flip. They were already looking for a reason to dislike her, like, and be proud to dislike her. And when she did the monkey thing, it was like, you can't do that. You cannot do that. Listen,
I definitely feel like this piece formally is made entirely in the same fashion that I would normally make a painting. I kind of have this this substrate. For me, the substrate in the audio piece is my monologue. In the paintings, it would be the canvas, the consistent piece of canvas that all the applique parts are attached to. And then I have these collage bits and pieces that seek to like further articulate, you know, my core idea. And in the audio piece, it's the fragments that I found from this, you know, these source materials. And then in the paintings, it would be all the different collage aspects, the assemblage aspects that I kind of attach to the canvas.
Remember to strive to reach your most feminine looking potential. That's the objective here. The more feminine, the less basic. Another tip is intentionally play up other feminine or pleasant characteristics that are not physical. Be strategic and intentional with the way you behave. Be intentionally confident, even if you don't feel like being confident at that moment in time. If it's going to benefit you to be confident and put a smile on your face, do that. Have a pleasant attitude, even when you don't feel like having one, because it makes you more attractive. Be friendly when you need to be. Pay attention. Talk less and listen more. Study people. Learn people more than they learn you so that you can use them to your benefit. And this is part of using femininity strategically. You may call it manipulative and say it's negative, but that's part of what being feminine is about. Using glamour, using charm, using your intelligence to captivate other people and persuade them to act in your favor.
Every individual's identity, once it's formed, it appears to be inherent, or maybe in some instances, inherited. But in reality, I think that it's more so a collection of bits and pieces of things you've picked up along your, you know, lifetime, things that you gravitate towards, that you identify with, but also things that have been projected or attached to you. So through all of that, through that kind of gumbo of things, and you form into who you are, or at least who you believe you are, and then that constructs one's identity. So I think that's something that's actually how everyone's self-image is constructed.
Sometimes I would eat less because if I ate less, then maybe it wouldn't be so bad. So there was also accompanying with this pain, there was lots of blood. And I didn't realize this at the time, but Perhaps it was my system not able to digest all of these salads because I'm eating so many salads and so much fruits and stuff. And so my system, it was just too much, so that I was actually causing I later found out from my doctor was diagnosed it as a arterial malformation of the colon, which I never had that before. There was some formula for this and whatnot. Not realizing at the time how closely gut health is related to psychological health, I began developing a lot of psychological issues. Not really just sort of like typical depression, but more like just sort of a crumbling of reality, a crumbling of my sense of how to construct understandings of things.
What that woman is describing as like the state of her gut is meant to be analogous to, I think, the state of maybe the nation potentially. Like, so America, Americans, they have consumed all of this. They have consumed this information. They have consumed these products. They have consumed these beliefs. And now what? What's going to be the outcome? Are they going to become healthy? Are they going to become full? Are they going to become sick? You know, like, that's kind of the idea. Like, now that if you imagine the nation as a body, and it has consumed all of these things, now, is that a healthy body? Is that an ill body? Is that a weak body? Is that a frail body? It's like, how is that body feeling? How does that body appear? What can that body now do? And this goes into another interest of mine, in which I want to think about figuration on a different level. So a lot of times you think about figuration and figurative work, and you think about an individual, their personality, their experiences, and the opinions that other people have about them, or what that body experiences socially or politically. But I think there's equally as interesting or as telling to imagine what that body, to understand that body more on a holistic level and imagine what that body consumes, and maybe trying to understand that body from the inside out. So I am interested in like food, consumption, health, and conversations about the body in that regard for those reasons. And that woman who's speaking about the state of her gut, she's talking about having to, like, how she became ill because of a diet that she chose, and kind of how at the end she felt like it wasn't worth it, and it wasn't a natural decision that she made, and she kind of had to suffer with the physical consequences of that and the damage that it has done to her overall health.
Are you attentive to your own diet? Like, do you have a specific diet that is important to you?
I actually don't, to be honest. I actually eat everything. And I also watch and listen and read to everything, good and bad things. I should probably be more restrictive, because I think that all the things that you listen to and read and watch and eat, they all affect you, you know? But again, it's just my curiosity. I want to know and hear and see and explore lots of different things. Even things that I know maybe I'm better off not having in my head.
Like, what would be an example of that?
I guess I listen to a lot of, again, to my, you know, I have this fascination with YouTube. So there are so many different like kinds of, it can become very political on YouTube. So I listen to the whole gamut of like political spectrums on the internet. And sometimes I think, oh, I shouldn't be listening to this. Like, I feel so strongly against it. But I have this curiosity to know like what other people think. I guess it gives me, it helps define the boundaries, I guess, for me. So I know you can go this far on to that, to the right, you can go this far to the left, you can go that far north, that far south. And then now you have a lay of the land. And everything that can exist exists within these boundaries. It can help you understand certain ideas you want to confront, that could also help you generate ideas that exist outside the boundaries, which I think is ultimately my main goal in doing these kinds of experiments.
Yeah, I mean, that doesn't sound like stuff you shouldn't be listening to. That sounds like a very wise approach that I wish more people took, in which they were willing to investigate things that weren't just in their echo chamber. But I am very sensitive about what I watch and experience, but in a different way, more like for me, like violence, you know, maybe a small drop of awareness about violence is good, but maybe the amount that we consume can actually be dangerous to us.
I actually agree with you about that. This is something that actually relates to some of the other things we've discussed. I think that it's odd too that there's so that they show like all of the examples of Black people who have been like murdered by police officers. I think that it's, I don't think it's appropriate that those things are shown and on television in the ways that they are. I think again in some ways that it kind of normalizes this idea that it's okay to show a dead or you know harmed Black body, and I feel like I can't think of a time I've ever seen a white person murdered on television. I've never seen that on TV.
I mean, the one that immediately comes to mind that we've all probably seen is JFK, right?
Oh, JFK. That's true. That actually is true.
It seems like this show's probably your most direct engagement with identity politics, right? And I wonder if you found that this has focused your audience more towards people who tend to share your politics. Have you found that to be the case?
I mean, only people who are not true, you know, patrons of the arts could feel that way. Because, for example, one of my favorite films is The Godfather. I'm not Italian, but I love The Godfather. I've learned so much about life from that film because it's an allegory. They're just using the vehicle of this one family and this one moment in time with this one community of people who are very much embedded in their ethnic identity in a particular moment in American history to tell a larger allegorical story. So, I mean, I love Grease. I'm not white, but I love the movie Grease. I mean, you can read into it and you can extract anything you want out of it because it's a story. It's a larger story. It is used. All the identity politics are just vehicles to tell a story. I mean, I do the same thing with my work, I feel like. I feel like I'm just using my own personal politic, my own personal narrative to tell a larger story that anyone could glean something from if they chose to. Because it should never be an instance in which the identity politic of any particular narrative should prevent you from understanding the larger humanist, you know, themes being discussed or the larger existential concerns. Because in that case, that would mean every single film, every single novel, every single song, every single piece of artwork that was created by any person that reflects their cultural or ethnic or racial or national identity would be completely opaque to anybody outside of that community, which we know is not true. That's how I view art that deals strongly with identity politics. But personally, honestly, I think all art deals with identity politics.
Even artists who kind of reject that idea and like try to push against it, you think it's still in there?
The fact that they're running away from it speaks to what it means to them. You're running away from something, it must have quite a hold on you, you know? Like you feel like you need to distance yourself from it. It's something that you spend quite a lot of energy thinking about.
Do you have a perspective on, you know, how the European tradition can be dealt with for individual artists right now, that you see people doing it in a way that is compelling?
I think that is a burden to everyone, this whole, you know, those people are somebody and you're nobody, you know, or those people are other and we're just as we are. That becomes burdensome to everybody. It becomes toxic to everybody at some point. And I think that that point is coming very, very soon if it hasn't already arrived. it might appear to be to have no, to for everyone to feign as if you have no identity can appear to be liberating, but at some point it starts to feel like an erasure. And that's what you constantly hear. They're trying to erase us. They cannot erase us. They feel as if they don't exist.
When you say the moment is coming soon, what moment were you referring to?
I think the moment that's going to be coming soon is a realization that there is not white people and everybody else. That's a falsehood. That is not reality. But white people, at the end of the day, for a long time, have just been considered people in general. And I feel like that's why with the this whole idea of like identity art or identity politic art or whatever, people only really have that conversation with artists of color or artists, queer artists or, you know, women artists. But in reality, everyone's art, even white male artists, their art is too about their own identity. Even in a work like a Pollock, that an anthropologist can look at it and say that maybe some of those gestures remind them of certain kinds of Native American work, artworks, and that possibly this artist is American, or that these gestures look like ejaculation, maybe this artist is male. So I don't believe that that work is completely devoid of any kind of clues as to who the maker is.
It's interesting to try and think of work that could kind of evade that kind of analysis, you know? What would that be?
I think they only evade that analysis within the culture in which they're produced. You would take that artwork and put it into a different culture, show it in a different cultural context. People, I think, would be able to guess quite a lot about the maker. Take a Rothko, for example, and show it to Aboriginal. Do you think that they would be able to guess maybe the racial identity of the maker? Say that maybe this is a, you know, a European, someone of European descent made this work. Just because it looks so different than the artwork that exists within that community, they know it's not from their community. And just at that moment in which you make a delineation that this work is not from my community, that already is othering it to some degree. So my point is that a lot of these perspectives, they appear to be true, but they're not actually true. They're just so much embedded in the perspective that you're in. So a lot of Black art appears to be Black art because the people who are making that assumption are non-Black people. Does that make any sense? Just logically, everyone has some kind of identity. And if someone doesn't have an identity, if there's a person, an artist, or an individual who doesn't have an identity, that's a very dangerous person. That person is likely to be a psychopath.
Thanks for listening to Subject Object Verb. We love making it and hope you love listening. If you do, maybe drop a comment into the podcast app or pass us a note at subjectobjectverb@artreview.com. Talk to you next month.